Hello and welcome to The Leap of Faith. On the programme this evening, the challenging concept of the pursuit of wealth by those of the Christian faith. Shortly, I'll be talking with Dr. Kevin Hardigan from the Jesuit Centre for Faith and Justice. In his new book, he asks, how can Christians square the principles of their faith with the balances of their bank accounts? We'll also hear from the Reverend Miosan Kodo Kilroy of Zen Buddhism Ireland and President of the Irish Buddhist Union on their aim of bringing a Buddhist philosophy to Irish society. It's been a week where the Archbishop of Dublin, Diarmaid Martin, reminded Roman Catholics in Ireland that they can't be forced to obey laws which go against the basic principles of their faith. He was referring to debates on the regulation of termination of pregnancy bill. The Archbishop also this week expressed his surprise at hearing for the first time through the media here that Pope Francis had replied to a letter about mother and baby homes in Ireland from the Minister for Children and Youth Affairs, Catherine Zappone. Taoiseach Leo Varadkar has since said that the Pope's letter was an acknowledgement rather than a substantive response. The 2018 Black Santa sit-out at St Anne's Church, Dawson Street, Dublin, was launched on Thursday by the Archbishop of Dublin, Most Reverend Dr. Michael Jackson, and the Lord Mayor of Dublin, Niall Ring. This is the 18th year that the Black Santa sit-out has been held in Dublin, and in that time, well over €600,000 has been raised for good local causes. And so to our first guest. Dr. Kevin Hardigan is a theologian working for the Jesuit Centre for Faith and Justice and author of a new book called Theological Ethics in a Neoliberal Age. Kevin is going to require a bit of explanation, but I'd like to start with your definition of what it is to be neoliberal.
Well, neoliberal is one of these words that people at dinner parties would drop into the conversation to appear as if they're learned and erudite, but often is used in a very vague fashion. I think it's important for us to recognise that it's a real phenomenon and it can be properly described. So neoliberalism isn't an economic theory, it's a political movement that seeks to take fundamentally economic ideas and then put them into practice in terms of policy. So the hallmarks of neoliberalism are a belief that the market is the most efficient way to distribute scarce resources, that competition is natural to human beings, and that the private individual has to take kind of solitary responsibility for their own well-being. And those three ideas operate in a complex way, so that a politician might, for example, tell you that Ireland should be organised to benefit those who get up early in the morning. That's neoliberalism in practice, as opposed to some kind of vague concept that nobody is quite sure what it means.
And how does that fit in then with an organisation like the Jesuit Centre for Faith and Justice? Is it saying that's a bad thing?
We would definitely be critical of the neoliberal impulse. To say that it's just a bad thing flatly really doesn't advance the conversation much. The JCFJ, the Jesuit Centre, focuses on housing and homelessness, on environmental justice, on penal reform, and on economic ethics. And we would identify in each of those areas neoliberal trajectories and trends that have arguably made Ireland worse. It's a less generous and less just place to live in. So our criticism of neoliberalism is, if we make the provision of housing entirely about profit, you're going to have 10, 15,000 people homeless. So instead of getting into abstract political conversations about the best way to order our society, we like to pay attention to the details. And when we find neoliberalism as the source of the problematic details, what can we do except criticise it?
I think there are parallels, though, between people's profession of their faith and the theory you're putting forward here, because are Irish people then, by your suggestion, passive or active in their neoliberalism?
I think we're all pretty much passive, but we're passive collaborators, let's put it that way. So I don't think anyone is sitting around saying, I would love to live in a society where healthcare is so scarce that old people very often are on trolleys for hours and hours on end before they get seen. Nobody wants that. And yet we're committed to a certain understanding of personal freedom and individual prosperity, primarily around low taxes. That means that we can't provide the sort of healthcare that we all would want in an ideal situation. So we're passive in the sense that we haven't designed this situation to suit our ends. But at the same time, our private individual decisions have added up to a society where the marginalised and the poor are more and more vulnerable with every passing year.
Okay, let's go back to the fundamentals of this then. And if we're going to look at it from a theological perspective, what would Jesus do?
This is a great question. And that's why I went off to study this topic for 5 years, because I really wanted to know, what would Jesus say to Ireland after the end of the Celtic Tiger? And I think that the very short answer is Jesus would encourage radical experimentation and generosity. Instead of hoarding our goods for ourselves, he would suggest that they are gifts given by God and are meant to be given on to others. So we live in this neoliberal imagination that holds that if we have something, we have to cling to it, otherwise it will be taken from us. It's so much better to let go of that anxiety by giving in the first place. And if we each ratchet up our generosity, it's not just that there'd be a social good that comes from giving to others. Our own internal disposition towards wealth would be liberated. We're possessed at the moment by our possessions. And if we learn to hold those things more lightly, we'll also find that we are able to move around society and around ourselves, our own souls, with a lot more freedom, if that makes sense.
It does, but it comes in the back of my mind of something, and I was talking to somebody about this recently, about somebody who expressed to me that they had an absolute fear of poverty. And that therefore that was their motivation rather than some form of theological principle.
And this is really at the nub of our problem as individuals. I have a little game, a mischievous game I play when I visit churches, and I ask people what it is they need for them to have a sense that they have enough now. Mm. And the answer that everybody has always given, regardless of where I am, regardless of who I'm talking to, is more. Nobody has ever said, I have enough. And this is a particularly bizarre situation if we think about it historically. 100 years ago, if people could imagine the kind of prosperity that was common in Ireland in 2018, they'd say, these must be the happiest people on planet Earth. They're guaranteed to have food and there's reasonably good services available. And yet, instead, we're more anxious and more depressed and more harried and more exhausted than people in the past could possibly have conceived of. So it's this fear of poverty, this fear of losing out, that drives us to commit to individual prosperity instead of communal good. And I think if we recognise that impulse within ourselves and seek to do the soul work that's required for us to reorientate our desires towards reality, it's simply not realistic that we would end up famished to the point of starvation.
But I'm thinking of people listening to us this evening as we're having this conversation who are, you know, desperately trying to maybe keep, if they're in the gig economy or the zero-hour contract economy, they're trying to keep maybe 2-3 weeks of money in the bank, or people who are trying desperately to save for a deposit for a house. They're not necessarily perceiving themselves as in the gathering of wealth. They're simply putting themselves into a situation where they feel they will be okay.
And this is our tension. On an individual level, we're driven by this fear of poverty. And on a communal level, we're incapable of showing the kind of solidarity that's required to help those who are existing in precarious employment, to help the young people who have no hope of getting the kind of financial basis together that would allow them to buy a home, establish a family, the kinds of things that had been taken for granted in previous generations. So the fear of poverty drives us to act as solitary individuals, and then a whole society of people acting for their own interest creates the context where we have more and more people who are genuinely at risk of poverty. So theologically, we have to recognise that the reality of the situation is that Ireland is not suffering from scarcity. We have an abundance, we have prosperity, but we do need to redistribute that so that it's shared more equally. And that requires getting up out of ourselves and out of our fears. And instead of being driven by the fear of losing something, we should be motivated by the possibility of building something. And that sense of social solidarity and the pursuit of the common good is something that ordinary Christians can put into practice in their own lives, in their parishes, in their dioceses. That's a realistic.
OK, so here's a standard criticism that I think is going to come your way in this argument, is that you look at some churches, and I know you perceive it from a Presbyterian perspective rather than necessarily a Roman Catholic one, but some of the times you might look at the church and say, it is very wealthy, it has an awful lot of assets. How about it starts there with that theology?
Absolutely. I would, if there are members of parish councils listening into this conversation on a Friday night, I would encourage you to go and pay attention to the resources that your parish has and think creatively and theologically about what you might be able to do with them to serve the common good. There's lots of land sitting around empty, and we can think there's a lot of very creative people in the Catholic Church who can put together ideas for how to put our resources into conversation with the lack of housing. That's something we can do. The churches can make a much more positive contribution to the common good. But I think that that begins on the local level, in the parishes, in individual conversations after church. Mm. My hope from this book would be that Christians would come to see that the familiar message of Jesus is actually much stranger than we have presented it. And it's subversive teaching around economics is the path to our liberation on this whole question.
Has the Christian faith then lost its ethos, its right to talk at all about this particular topic at this stage?
I think in Ireland in 2018, we as Christians need to be chastened in our speech. Our public record, our stance in terms of justice has not been good. And we need to go back to basics and sort out our own house before we start to tell other people how to organise theirs. So my drive in the book, the final chapter, looks at worship and how worship has this political potential. And that is an attempt to try to encourage Irish Christians to organise their parishes so that they do reflect the values of Jesus.
Because what we're talking about here is a concept of moral compass, aren't we?
That would be one way to think about it, yeah, for sure. That our moral compasses are pulled off course by the desires that neoliberalism induces in us. And we need to reorientate and recalibrate our compasses so that they direct towards the purpose that they were intended for, which is ultimately God's beauty, and that's expressed in terms of social justice.
So is this a more socialist outlook rather than a capitalist or neoliberalist one?
I very, very carefully in the book argue that this is not a socialist proposition, although I think that Christians have a lot in common and lots of places where they can overlap with left-wing politics. Christianity cannot possibly be held captive by any one particular variety of political action. And through the parables, we see this very clearly, because in Jesus' storytelling, he can't be fit into any box of his own day or of our own. Sometimes he seems like he is radically communistic. And at other times, he tells these stories about landowners that they're worse than any landlord you've heard
of. And the parables are particularly something that you refer to, and they're very useful to. But I'm thinking about the idea of talents. And that's the one parable that stuck out for me when I was looking back over it, was that we are encouraged to make the best of what we have and the best of our resources. And therefore, the sequence of the best is that we in some way gain or are rewarded for it.
Yeah, the parable of the talents is one of those stories that everybody knows vaguely, but nobody really has ever paid attention to. So it's typically preached from the pulpit in a homily very briefly in terms of you've got certain gifts, you should use them to maximise their effectiveness, and if you don't,
the ROI
will punish you.
Yeah,
return on investment, yeah. That's what God's interested in. Of course, in the story, it's much more interesting than that, because the third guy, the guy who receives these harsh words, he buries his deposit because he says that his boss is a harsh and cruel taskmaster who he's frightened of. But there's no evidence in the story that he is harsh. And in fact, he invites his two other employees, not just to a company Christmas party or to an annual bonus, but into friendship. So God is depicted consistently in the parables as this gregarious, generous character. And very often the characters in the parables are there to negatively flesh that out. So the parable of the talent speaks to us today by suggesting, again, with the moral compass idea, that if we're imagining that God is harsh, cruel and judgmental, then we're going to act in that way towards our neighbours. And that is the exact opposite of the kingdom of God. Because God is generous and trustworthy, we can be generous and trustworthy and know that he will invite us into his friendship.
Are you able to get to the right ears, Kevin?
The right ears for me are ordinary Christians. So a radio show like this is much more valuable to me than an opportunity to sit down with the Minister for Housing. Although it would be great to be able to sit down with Owen Murphy and explain how neoliberalism will invariably lead to thousands and thousands of people who are homeless, I'm still sufficiently democratic in my impulses to think that the ordinary Christian in Port Leash or in Westport has the potential to live out their faith in a way that's authentic, and in so doing, serve the whole community. That's, I think, the promise of Christianity in the 21st century for Ireland.
Dr. Kevin Hardigan, thank you for joining us on the programme this evening. And you can get more information on Kevin's book on our website. Just search for RTE The Leap of Faith to get our listings. That piece is called Blowing Zen on the shakuhachi, a bamboo flute, taking us to our next guest on our show this evening. Ian Kilroy was born into the Roman Catholic faith, but later converted to the Buddhist religion and was ordained as a Buddhist priest. He's been involved in the recent formation of the Irish Buddhist Union. Ian is their president. And he was also consulted in the drafting of the new curriculum for ORE at junior cert level. Ian joins me now in the studio this evening. Ian, you now, of course, have a Dharma or Buddhist name. Tell us about that.
So my name is Reverend Myozan Kodo. So it's made up of four Chinese characters. Myo is wondrous, Zan is mountain, Ko is flourishing, and Do is way. So wondrous mountain, flourishing way. It's a very impressive title altogether, very impressive Dharma name. But typically, of course, Buddhist names or Dharma names are poetic because the Zen tradition and the Chan tradition in China, which Zen comes out of into Japan, you know, is a very poetic kind of spiritual tradition informed by Taoism.
Now, one of the things that has been very obvious over the last couple of years is the increase in secularization, people leaving behind their faith, in many cases a Christian faith. You did something the same as well, but you didn't go to atheism or agnostic. You went to a specific faith. What was the drive behind that?
I think that Buddhism acknowledges realities other than the materialistic and material reality. And I just can't subscribe to, I suppose, to a worldview that sees everything only as in materialist terms. Buddhism made sense to me. That's simply it, on an intellectual level, on an emotional level, but more than that, as a Zen Buddhist, as a practice, because it doesn't matter so much what I believe philosophically about who made the world and everything else. Zen is a practice. And it's a practice that has results. You know, you see it in your own life, the way it enriches your own spirit.
If you're not Zen, what are you? Does it mean we're angry?
No. Polar opposites are something that Zen tries to break through. It's a non-dualistic understanding. So things aren't either just material or spiritual. In the Zen understanding, things are both material and spiritual. So we have a non-dualistic understanding of reality. So we aren't either just Zen or misguided or angry or deluded. We are either one or the other in any given moment. And the skillful practice what we try to cultivate through this practice is to be more wise and compassionate in each of those any given moments. Zen means meditation. The word Zen comes from the Chinese word Chan, which comes from Dhyana, the Sanskrit word for meditation. So the word Zen just means meditation. So the emphasis in the Zen Buddhist school is very much on the still calmness, the equilibrium of mind, body and spirit that comes from sitting in meditation.
Now, some people may actually have been inadvertently practicing Buddhism without necessarily being aware of it. How would that happen?
Well, I suppose that elements of Buddhist practice, Buddhist meditation practice, have been absorbed into some Christian spiritual practices. And indeed, the great popular expression of Buddhist meditation is in secular mindfulness. Now, I would draw a distinction between mindfulness and Buddhist practice, because mindfulness is a very great and useful method to come to a place of stillness and to calm oneself, come to a place of calm and equilibrium using various meditation techniques. Buddhism, though, is interested in something kind of deeper than that. It has a context, a long philosophical context and ethical tradition which supports these practices. And I think in that sense that mindfulness has to be distinguished from Buddhism proper, you know.
Now, you could look at world faiths, and indeed we do on this program many a time, and you'll always see an element of peace, tranquility, love and caring. But not far behind is conflict and sometimes anger and war. Where does that weave into the Buddhist faith?
Buddhism, it would be naive, and people have been naive about Buddhism for a long time, and they intend to be naive about Buddhism, to think that it is not subject to human frailties and the problems that other faiths have. Of course, Buddhism preaches peace. It's generally a pacifist tradition, a non-violent tradition, a tradition that, that emphasizes wisdom and compassion. And these are very central and important things in Buddhism. But like any faith, it can be used and abused for political ends. We see that in Burma. We see that with the hyper-nationalist expression of so-called Buddhism in present-day Burma, which is engaged in genocide against the Rohingya people, the Muslim minority, driving them across the border into Bangladesh. Historically, we've seen that too in pieces in Asia. But more often than not, Buddhism has been the victim of violence. I suppose as the Islamic armies came through Afghanistan and Pakistan, where there were hundreds of ancient Buddhist monasteries, they were all swept away. And indeed, Buddhism was swept out of its native India as well.
Ian, we're exploring again with the idea of somebody turning to the Buddhist faith. And of course, this is not a recent phenomenon in Ireland. I believe there's a historical context of Buddhism appearing quite a long time ago in the country.
That's right. Lawrence Cox did some very seminal research on Buddhism in Ireland at Maynooth University. And he found that Buddhism has a longer history in Ireland than we thought. In fact, in the 6th and 7th centuries, there are mentions in Irish texts of Buddhism and the Buddhist faith. Possibly it would have come along the Silk Road and through Europe, this knowledge. Then in the 19th century, you know, before Irish independence, we were very much hooked up to the British imperial project, whether we liked it or not. And many Irish people would have gone overseas and ended up in places like Burma, as we mentioned earlier. Some of these people would have ordained as Buddhist monks. So back in the 19th century, we see really the first wave of Ireland and Buddhism.
And there would be a sense, in for me, just thinking back about it, it would be something you might have heard about in the 1960s or the 1970s. People dabbled, you know, they bought the statue, they lit incense and they did a little bit of meditation. What is the difference between that and then professing it ultimately as a faith?
Well, I think it's a bit like secular people celebrating Christmas and rather than being Christian. I think that Buddhism has very, very recently come to a new level of maturity within Irish life. Buddhism has for a long time been something that has happened elsewhere, where Irish people would have gone to Asia and discovered Buddhism, or in previous years, like Shoshin Mora O'Halloran, the well-known Irish Zen monk who died tragically young in the 1980s, she would have had to go to a Japanese monastery to ordain and to become a Zen priest. And that was true until recently. Only in the last few years have the first wave of Irish Buddhist teachers come on stream. And I'm one of those, I suppose. There aren't many of us, but it has changed everything in Irish Buddhism. When you have the teachers, then the tradition, the institutions, the Buddhist schools can follow.
Well, what are the practicalities for you living in this country? For example, you're admitted to a hospital and you say that in the admission form that you're Buddhist. What happens next? Is there a system or a process to support you, for example?
There is not. There's a lot of work to be done for minority faith traditions in Ireland. Ireland's diversity, which has now been around for a little while, has not been accommodated adequately by the state and by state institutions. So one of the jobs that needs to be done is to ensure that that changes. So I represent Buddhism on the Dublin City Interfaith Forum, for example, and we're trying to progress that accommodation for diversity. And now in this new Irish Buddhist Union, which I've established with other sanghas in Ireland, with the mainstream sanghas are all represented on it, we together are trying to ensure that diversity is accommodated as well.
Why do you need a union?
Irish Buddhism, yes, has never really had a kind of a body to speak for it, and has been very fractured, you know, into its various schools of Buddhism. And as Ireland becomes more diverse as a society, and through my work in the Dublin City Interfaith Forum, I began to see that, you know, this diversity needed to be accommodated in some ways, in terms of health services, chaplaincy services in hospitals and in universities and colleges, in the curriculum, the religious knowledge curriculum. And then I realised as well that Irish Buddhism never doesn't have a voice or a platform to express its point of view with regard to these issues. So About a year and a half ago, I began to make contact with other Buddhists, prominent Buddhists and Buddhist groups and schools in Ireland, to see if we could come together and form a union in order to express a Buddhist view and to feed into national policy as it's formulated in order to accommodate our new diversity.
So it's about a place at the table. Yeah,
it is indeed.
So for parents of children and they want to put them into an education system, how is that recognised? What are the options open to them?
Well, I mean, I'm a father myself. Myself and my wife have two children, two boys, and it was quite difficult to find a non-denominational or multi-denominational option. Now, we got our boys into a multi-denominational school where they look at Christianity and they look at Judaism and Islam and Buddhism, and that made us very happy, but it was difficult to get them in. In Dublin, I think we have some choice, but a lot of the country has no choice. And, you know, we should have that choice. I would prefer to see us not go in the kind of hard secular direction that France has gone. I think spirituality is vital. It's part of who we are. It addresses the big questions of life and death. And to see the diversity of these great rich traditions being introduced to young people in a non-proselytizing way is very important, rather than just throw it all out.
Ian, thank you for joining us this evening. And you can get more information on the Irish Buddhist Union on their website, ibu.ie. And that's The Leap of Faith for this week. Join us next week when our guest is psychotherapist, musician and singer Deirdre Ni Canéide. From all of us here tonight, good night.